Here's a digital recording of the Stephen Downes presentation at the KEGSA conference in Adelaide, July 2007.
There's all kinds of evidence for this, in my view, that this model is false. And I've captured that recently in, if you will, slogan form by saying something like, learning is not remembering. Learning something is different from remembering. And how do I characterize or capture that? Please slow down later on. I was really inspired early. But if you can remember A, because that's what the teacher told you, you can even put A on the test. But what does A mean? Does it mean anarchy? A plus, A this, A that, or is it the shape of the Eiffel Tower in Paris? Who knows? It's an empty memory. And if you think about it, you can imagine cases of empty memories yourself. How many of you recall Lewis Carroll? 'Twas brilliant in this flighty talk. And everybody remember that? What does it mean? You remember it, but it has no meaning, does it? I'm sure you can all, if those of you who are teachers, this is how most of you, can all remember cases when students have come up and used the word, and it's so clear by the way they use the word, they remember the word, they have no idea what it means. It's not just in language, you get empty math as well. And one of the cases where people argue for rote learning is multiplication tables, right? You at least need that, right? You gotta at least memorize that. Well, in one of my earlier lives, I spent a lot of time working in convenience stores and concession stands selling hot dogs and popcorn and things like that. I worked with a lot of people. I even became a trainer there eventually, which is kind of weird. Total coincidence. But what I've discovered is people graduate high school, have learned the multiplication tables, right? But when they go to make change, they don't have what they call mathematical common sense. Right? You buy something for $1.50, you give them a 20, they give you back a 5, they don't get that something was wrong there. It just doesn't click. Or they punch something out on the calculator, right? And they get, instead of $10 change, $89.45, and you start counting out the 20, it just doesn't click. So you actually have to teach new clerks or new concession stand workers actually how to count change up. And there's a very specific process of counting change because they don't have mathematical instincts. They have a memory, but they don't have meaning. I also saw this playing darts. I don't know how many of you play darts. Any of you? No. I'll point in the back. Okay, well, all the darts players are in the back. That's interesting. There's probably something very sociological about that. Really bad. Sorry. But you're getting darts, right? You throw your dart and you're throwing at numbers, and the whole idea is you need to add up your numbers. And there are stages of dart number awareness, right? The first stage is the realization you can use multiplication. Because you're shooting like 517, right? And 5 up. Well, how many is up? But this multiplier. Oh, yeah. And there's this moment of awareness where people realize they can multiply 5 times 17. And then the second stage is how to multiply 5 times 17, because they only learned up to 12. And then the third thing is how dart players actually multiply, which actually demonstrates an awareness of what the numbers actually mean. Dart players, I'll give you a simpler example, 5 times 19. Figure it out in your head. What's 5 times 19? Well, it's 5 times 20 minus 5, 95. You see, their players don't actually multiply the numbers. They pick something simpler and then move faster. They know what the quantities mean rather than what just the symbols are. Learning is not remembering. Learning is not content. Learning is a process of becoming something rather than a process of acquiring. To learn is to instantiate patterns of connectivity in your mind. You don't make meaning. Sorry, I hit that slide a little bit late. Never mind. We'll come back to that. I can't believe I hit my slide early. I just show what happens in real life as well as in the virtual world. To learn to instantiate patterns of connectivity in the mind, you don't make meaning or construct meaning, you grow meaning. Learning is, now I'll do my plug. Learning is two major things. It's ineffable. It's sub-symbolic. It's forming connection rather than having content. I feel like a weather person. It's contextual. This is specific for each person. It's not generalizable like the letter A. Okay. Let's a very quick jump through the idea of what learning is. Now what I want to do is hash that out a little bit with network learning in particular. So here's the map for the talk. And I'm not hitting this early this time. Yellow really comes out, doesn't it? I wasn't sure it would. Okay. We'll look at what learning is, and we'll see that learning divides into, or is at the same time, network learning and personal learning. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the properties of each of those, bringing those back together with the reliability of learning, and then we'll follow back with some examples of how all of these principles are applied to the design and evaluation of web software. So this talk really is going somewhere. How am I going so far? Again, I don't have sound, so you have to sort of... okay, I don't know what the leaves mean. I know what the nods mean, though, so that's good.
You're doing very well, Stephen. I particularly like these roll-away options. Very good.
All right, I wish somebody was videotaping this. Oh, well. It's very funny because I have nice slides here. Okay, to review, knowledge is not like acquisition, it's more like recognition, it's more like perception. It's the acquisition of new patterns of connectivity, new pictures, if you will, in your mind through experience. Learning is recognition. And you should recognize, if I don't drop it, you recognize, right? You didn't count anything to see that, you didn't look at any properties or anything like that. You looked at that, you recognize it. That's what learning is. It's patterns and similarities. It's not rules and categories. And this is something that you've seen already when I talked about this. If there were simply the acquisition of content, if it were simply stuff that's coming in, then you wouldn't have things like the aha phenomena, or you wouldn't have thoughts that come out of the blue, or leaping to conclusions, or anything like that, because it would just be simply cumulative. It's a recognition thing where you snap into an awareness of something. I sometimes talk to people, ask me, what is knowledge like? And I said, well, knowledge is like finding Waldo. Do you have Where's Waldo in Australia? Somebody right, little Waldo with a little hat. Like, he's in the picture, there's Waldo, and there's like 8 million other things around him. You have to look at the picture and find Waldo. Right? I used to go to this one dentist, and I had Where's Waldo on the ceiling. And the first grade. So the thing is, once you found Waldo, you can't unfind him. But knowledge is like that. It's like, I see it. You snap into awareness. And what's happened there is that you've acquired a particular pattern of connectivity in the mind. And where that leads us to is this. personal learning, that is to say, the learning that, it's kind of like Waldo, isn't it? Personal learning, the learning that you and I do, is essentially the same as network learning. These two things are one and the same. The properties through which a network learns are the same as the properties by which a person learns. I'm going to look at personal learning first. And I'm not going to say that these are the alternate principles of personal learning. These are principles that I come across just in my own reading, writing, reflecting, and occasional learning. But I think that whatever your particular approach to personal learning is going to be similar to this. And it's, similar enough that you can follow the same sort of methodology that I'm following, even if your results are slightly different. So personal learning, basically, boils down to three major principles. These are what I would call principles of effective personal learning. I don't know if it's better like this or like this. Like this or like this. At 12:30 in the morning, I'm very easily distracted. Interaction, usability, and relevance. Interaction. Now, we have lots of people talk to us about interaction and the need for interaction and all of that. But what does interaction actually boil down to? What constitutes good interaction versus bad interaction? Well, in my mind, they are going to slow down, don't worry. There's a few principles of interaction that I think are important. Pull, for example, is better than push. By pull, what I mean is that you select the content that you want to do. You find the content that you want to do. You pick the people that are going to talk to you. It's the difference between choosing which website you want to see, say, and receiving spam in your email. Pulling websites in and choosing them allows you to select content that you want, whereas if content is pushed at you like spam, while you get mostly stuff you don't want. Interaction, people say, and I agree, should be in a genuine voice. It should be you reflecting your own knowledge, experience, and opinion. And I think the most important thing about interaction, certainly in my experience, is that it needs to be a habit. It needs to be something that you do on a regular basis. One of the things that I do is my newsletter. And my newsletter is a major form of interaction for me because it's me bringing stuff in. It's reading all these different blogs and things like that, email messages and whatever that's out there on the internet. And it's also me sending my ideas and my opinions and even a little bit of knowledge. But the important thing and what makes the newsletter work is that I do it on a regular basis. It's the sort of thing I do every weekday, pretty much every weekday. And it's a habit. It's like, I eat breakfast, pet the cat, I do the newsletter. It's just a regular part of my life. And it's creating that flow, that process, is what makes the interaction actually work. The second of the principles is usability. And in thinking about this, I mean, reading a great deal of Jacob Nielsen and other people, in my mind, usability boils down to consistency plus simplicity. Now, I know there's more to usability than that. And, we could probably become more detailed, but if you wanted to, to narrow it down to some simple principles that you can work on and use as a way of looking at software, looking at design, then consistency and simplicity work really well. And if you look at the websites out there that are the most usable, or what's the most usable of all, probably Google, right? So Google is very consistent. It hasn't changed practically since the day it was born, and it's very simple. Google, there's a search form. You type in the search form, you're done. That's, in my mind, the ultimate of usability. The third principle is relevance, and relevance is. Sorry, I've got markers here. Oh, that's great. got markers flying all over the room. I got paper under my chair. Never mind. I'm leaving God. Next time we do this, you guys get up at 12:30 in the morning. Relevance has to do with need. It has to do with value. A lot of people think of relevance in terms of content. Relevance, to a large degree, has very little to do with content. I tell people to watch the flow as opposed to the content. The idea here is that it's not about remembering things. Again, we go back to the original principle. Rather, it's about being exposed to things that you need. And I think about darts a lot, maybe more than I should. But it's always struck me as interesting that, in a nation where they really value technology and industry and commerce, that in the pub, of every pub, of every little town, is this counting game. And people go and they spend their whole night drinking beer and counting and adding and multiplying. And somebody way back when was either very brilliant or very lucky in my mind. Anyhow, it's the repeated exposure, it's the function, the need, how did I want to put it? Relevance is defined by function as opposed to topic or category. Relevance is about what you are attempting to do rather than what you're thinking about or talking about. Relevance has to do with need. If something is relevant if you need it, if you don't need it, it's not as relevant. I guess that's almost a tautology, isn't it? Now, I skip through those principles very quickly, but that's because I don't have a long time for this. I'm going to move on now to the other side of the house. A very quick look at personal learning. Now I want to talk about network learning. So personal learning, these are the sorts of habits that I've found or that I think that are useful and helpful in understanding how to set up one's personal learning. But now, if you're trying to teach a network to learn things, now this is almost a computational process. It's the sort of thing that people like Minsky and Papert and Rummelhart and McClellan and others have done computationally with connectionist computer systems and the like. As well, teaching networks how to learn is the sort of thing that people who study neural networks, like for example the brain study. Network learning is essentially associationist learning. What that means is that, how do I want to put that? I have a little chart here, but that won't help unless I have the nice description. Associationist learning is like, I hate doing a talk at 1 in the morning. Associationist learning is essentially the formation of connections between entities where these connections are created by association of one or another phenomenon. So you have one phenomenon that's presented, another phenomenon that's presented, and the interaction of those phenomena on a network creates connections in that network. So the creation of a connection in a network is the creation of an association. How is that? It'll have to do. There's three major types of associationism. There's Hebbian associationism, backpropagation, and Boltzmann mechanism. Hang on a second. Sorry, I have accumulated a debris field behind me. Hebbian association. sometimes known as simple associationism, and it's very simple. It works like this. You have one entity and another entity, right? If they both fire at once, then a connection is drawn between them. And if they both don't fire at once, the connection is drawn. But if one fires, and the other one doesn't, that connection is weakened. So simple associationism is same things are connected. Imitation, basic imitation. Backpropagation now is a bit trickier. Backpropagation is, now you have a neuron, an entity in a network, you have another entity in a network, and you pretend you have a whole bunch of them. See, I'm trying to use a visual element here. You have a whole bunch of them. So you have connections that get formed, and then you send in a signal. I don't have enough hands. You send in a signal, and it goes through the connection, and then it comes out the other end, and then you have something at the other end that sends feedback. If it's the right sort of thing that should have happened, it doesn't do anything. But if it's the wrong sort of thing, it sends feedback. No, don't do that. It's sort of like slapping your brain on the lip. That's a lousy analogy. But the idea here is that you're training your network by giving it feedback. You're sending in signals back the opposite direction from the original input to adjust the connections. The third type is Boltzmann associationism. That's even trickier, but basically, you have your network, your connections all form, and what they try to do is settle into the most stable configuration, because the connections between neurons are not just, well, they're mechanical connections, but they're also electrical connections, and the connections have different strengths and different weights, and these neurons are firing and stopping and firing, as they fire back and forth, the connections are shifting and shifting and shifting, and eventually, like a puddle of water, it settles. But the thing is, it might not settle into the best configuration possible. It's kind of like a lake up on a mountain, right? It's settled, but it could go further down, right? If it was just moved around a bit. And so that's what happens. You sort of shake the brain up a little bit, and it's like unsettling your configuration, then it settles to a more stable configuration. You shake it, and how is that? The whole idea here is that basically, these are mechanisms of creating connections with neurons and between neurons. And in some cases, there's external phenomena that create the connections. In other cases, a previously existing state or a corrective state will influence the connections. And in other cases, just simply the nature of the network itself, what counts as a stable state, will influence the connections. I have explained that better, but where that leads us to, if you look at those models, if you look at associationist learning, it is a picture of learning that basically looks like this. And in slogan form, it is to teach is to model and to demonstrate, and to learn is to practice and reflect. In other words, in teaching, what you're trying to do is to create an environment where people can have certain kinds of experiences. And then in learning, what you're trying to do is to have those experiences, and then, and this is the Boltzmann aspect of it, to reflect on them, to think about them, to make sense of them, if you will. So, on the one hand, we have personal learning, and on the other hand, we have network learning, and these are, as I said earlier in the talk, two sides of the same phenomenon. I'm describing the same thing when I describe network learning and personal learning. And when I describe network learning and personal learning, people always say, just like they say about the internet, well, how do you know it's reliable? How do you know if you're not getting some voice of authority, or if you're not getting, I don't know, peer review or whatever, that you're going to be learning the right thing, that what you know will be true? And On the one hand, there's no guarantee, just like there's no guarantee in anything, sorry about that. But on the other hand, there are ways that we can set up networks in such a way that networks can be known to be reliable. And this is what I call the semantic condition of the network. This is the last of the slides, by the way. I know you're going to miss me. This is the semantic condition. The diversity, autonomy, openness, and connectivity. Now, what do I mean by those? Well, by diversity, what I mean is that the process, if you will, has the widest possible spectrum of point of view. You have the widest possible number of types of input. The neurons or the entities that are in your network are as diverse as possible. If we're talking about conversation or interaction, the members of the conversation are from different backgrounds. They have different assumptions, different worldviews, approach matters from different perspectives. Autonomy is where the members of the network or the entities in the network are each acting of their own accord. It's where when networks are forming connections with other networks, for example, where these connections are each being formed independently. Or if a person is an entity in a network, for example, in a group or a decision-making process, each person is making their decision on their own. And rather than, say, acting by the orders or at the behest of some external authority or control or causal agent or something like that. The idea is that in a network, each entity in the network is independent and autonomous, making their own decisions. If you think about it, if you've ever read Marvin Minsky's Society of Mind, this captures that really nicely. In Society of Mind, Minsky talked about individual agents, and the whole idea in a Society of Mind is that each agent does their own thing, and their own thing might be really simple, like move the thing from here to here or whatever. And the mind is formed from all of these independent, autonomous agents, each trying to do their own thing. Openness is the principle that the network is, entities in the network can freely send signals to other entities in the network, and that, of course, is how connections are formed, and can freely receive signals. So, in other words, there's a free flow of information in the network, that there isn't a blockage of the sending of signals back and forth in the network. And you can imagine what would happen in your own brain if one neuron was not able to send a signal to another neuron. Your brain would essentially cease to function. And then, of course, the final principle is connectivity. Can the networks be connect, or can the entities in the network be connected? And can they form patterns of connectivity? Okay. Now you might be wondering, okay, I've given you this, I've given you that, I've given you, the picture of learning, personal learning, associative learning, the semantic condition. How does this all crash out? Well, if we think about the different sorts of things that we create in order to, foster learning, if you will, we can think of those things in terms of the model that I've just given you. Let's take the basic framework. The basic framework now of modeling and demonstrating, practice and reflection. Now think about the sorts of things that you can use to model. And I have a nice slide here which you can't see, but think about the types of technologies you can use to model, like say wikis or concept maps are things that you can use to model. Glyphy is a little modeling program that's online. Or frameworks or reference frameworks like Wikipedia or even documentation of something like an XML specification, other types of representations, video representations, 3D representations like, say, virtual worlds or things like that. So, okay. I'm not done. All right. So you think, okay, what about a wiki? All right, so let's think about a wiki, okay? And so we think about a wiki first in terms of associative learning. All right, now, does the wiki provide examples to follow? Well, that's one way to use a wiki. Another way to use a wiki, if we're thinking of back propagation, is a way to enable corrections and criticism. And then the third type of associationism, the Boltzmann mechanism, the shaking up and settling in, is a lot like rethinking and rewriting. And so what this does is this informs us of the purpose of a wiki, how the wiki is created, but it also tells us how to use the wiki. People sometimes think of a wiki as a publishing tool, but it's not a publishing tool, it's not the content that's important. Rather, it's a place to create examples, it's a place to create this correction, this back propagation, this feedback. It's a place to try something and rework it and rework it and rework it. Now we think about the personal learning part. I'm writing pretty well backwards, aren't I? I don't know if you can read it, but I can write it. Okay. Personal learning, interaction. I think that's very interesting. If you think about Wikipedia, Wikipedia has the wiki pages themselves, but what they discovered is that they needed to create discussions of those pages. They needed to add that interactive element to in order to resolve some of the differences of opinions that would occur regarding the precise wording of a page. Genuine voice. Is a wiki a case where you get genuine voice? Well, I think one of the big questions about Wikipedia is whether the so-called neutral point of view or objective point of view is something that can be sustained over time. It's one of the big areas of dispute. And we see that it's an area of dispute because we want genuine voice. That's really not much of a note, but you'll have to do. It takes it too hard to write. This is actually pretty heavy. You wouldn't believe it to look at it. Also, usability. Is the wiki usable? Is it a simple and consistent interface? Well, yes it is. This is in fact one of the big attractive things about a wiki. A wiki is a very simple interface. You have the wiki notation that you use to create the pages. And it's a consistent interface. It's the same notation from one wiki page or from one wiki to another. This is one of the big advantages. And I've always wondered, there's a wiki out there, a wiki site called JotSpot out there, and what they did is instead of using the standard wiki interface, they used one of those MS Word type interface where you push the little button for bold or italic or whatever. And I'm not sure that was an improvement, because although it exchanges one kind of consistency for another kind of consistency, it sacrifices simplicity in favor of a more complex interface. You can do more, but now it's not as simple anymore. So this is one of the sorts of questions that you ask when somebody introduces something like JotSpot. Another thing now, is the content of a wiki relevant? Is it accessible? Is it available where and when I need it? Well, in some cases, yes. Although one of the things that I've encountered in the use of the wiki We see things like corporate wikis or university wikis or things like that, and what characterizes them typically is that they're locked behind passwords, so you have to log in just to see them. And in the case of the wiki that we have here at NRC, you can't even access it unless you're in the NRC network. So for me, it's not accessible at all at home. That, according to these criteria, and in my own experience, makes the wiki a lot less useful. The wiki, in order to be useful, needs to be accessible. I need to be able to get at the content when I need it and where I need it. On the other hand, Wikipedia, which is open, is generally accessible. And now the question is, you know, can I make that content available in other places? One of the things I've done on my own website is to try to take Wikipedia content and put it right on the pages of my own site. I can do that. So that's a good thing about Wikipedia. And then finally, we ask questions about the reliability of the information of Wikipedia, or of wikis in general. So this will be the semantic condition. Wow, my writing gets worse the lower I go on the page. Okay, so first of all, do I have diversity? I'm not going to go much beyond that. Well, diversity in the world of wikis, what this tells us is that there's going to be a minimum threshold number of people required to make a wiki work well. A wiki with a small number of people is going to perform differently than a wiki with many people, because a wiki with a small number of people is going to be less diverse. There's going to be less points of view, fewer points of view. And in my mind, there's a very large difference between the reliability of a wiki like Wikipedia that's created by hundreds of thousands of people and the reliability of a wiki that's created by 10 or 15 people, maybe in your local company or your local school or whatever. People sometimes ask, well, how can you trust the information in a wiki? But this is one of the things you look at. How many people were involved in the creation of the content? How diverse were these people? Another element now is autonomy. Were the contributors to the wiki autonomous? Were they able to contribute their own perspective, their own point of view? In Wikipedia, manifestly, they can contribute their own point of view. Although, in a corporate wiki, we might ask whether people are able to freely contribute their own point of view, or whether they feel constrained by, if you will, a corporate line or something like that. So this is the sort of question that you ask when you're setting up the design for something like this. If you need your wiki to be reliable, then you're going to need some mechanism to ensure that the people can freely contribute to that wiki. And then connectedness. How well can you connect elements of the wiki to other elements of the wiki, and also how well can you connect elements of the wiki to external things? In Wikipedia, for example, one of the strengths of Wikipedia, and this is the way I use it a lot, is I go to a page in Wikipedia, and I don't cite the page, but Wikipedia has connections to all kinds of primary sources, resources, personal web pages, all kinds of stuff. So Wikipedia is not simply a place where I have information, but it's a starting point for a whole network of related information. And then finally, the openness. Can anybody contribute? Can anybody read or access the information? And again, this is the idea that something that is accessible is going to be more useful. That was a really bad way of phrasing it, but anyhow, how do I want to put it? Again, the wiki will be more reliable if people can openly contribute to it, if people can read it. One of the things that I sometimes say, perhaps a little bit cynically, is the reason some of these online publications lock themselves behind subscription walls isn't so much to raise the money, it's just that they don't want to be widely viewable across the internet, because they would be much more roundly criticized, were they? just openly viewable rather than viewable only to people who have already subscribed and paid the fees. I'm very cynical that way. Okay, so that's an example of a process. I can do that same sort of thing for the other types of things. For example, take demonstrations. Teaching is modeling and is demonstrating. Think of the sorts of things that we can use in order to demonstrate things. Well, one way we can demonstrate things is to use images. So we think about, say, image samples or image libraries. And do image libraries support these things? Well, image libraries are, they do offer examples, that's very clear to the case, but do they offer correction or rethinking? Well, not if they're just simple static image libraries. You're going to need to introduce some additional features to an image library in order to allow for feedback and comment. Like you might need little comment fields, say, underneath the images. And you need some way of allowing reuse of the images. You need to be able to download the images. You need licensing that will support that. Images, will they support personal learning? Will they support interaction? Well, the images themselves won't, but the image library could. If there was, for example, personal image library to allow people a genuine voice and comment areas, so that people can not just put the images up there, but their experiences related to the images and their opinions. They're putting up personal photos. By now, it's probably dawned that I'm not talking about just an image library, am I? I'm talking about something that resembles one of the darlings of the Web 2.0 world, something like Flickr, right? Where it's not just an image library, but it's some kind of online community. Images, does it have a simple and consistent interface? Flickr does have a simple and consistent interface. It's one of its major strengths. And are the images accessible when I need them to be? Well, Flickr, after a while, built something called the Flickr API, which means now that I can make my images available not just on the Flickr website, where they're not really that useful, but on my own, well, in my blog, for example. Or I can put them in email, or I can send them through a printer and make a calendar of them. In other words, my images are now available where I need them to be. You can even put them in Facebook in that these days. Okay, well, that's pretty good. How reliable is Flickr? And you might think, well, reliable Flickr? That doesn't make any sense. But again, if we're thinking here of knowledge not as content, but as networks, as connections, it does actually make sense to think about the reliability of an image collection. Well, Flickr is reliable. Flickr is very diverse. It has like thousands and thousands of members. These members work autonomously. They're not creating images for some company or some publisher. They're putting up their own images. They're connected. They create links to the images. Flickr, in fact, did something that very specifically connected images, and this was one of its great strengths, in tagging. Tagging was a way of drawing connections from one image to another image to another image to create sets or collections of images. And then finally, the openness. Anybody can add images to Flickr. Anybody can look at the images in Flickr. So, again, this metric here allows us to look at something as a basic thing like image collection, and then gradually, by looking at the different properties, you begin to shape what it should look like, and lo and behold, what it should look like comes out to be something like Web 2.0. And this is the lesson that I'm trying to draw out here. It's not that here's Web 2.0 and you should use it. Rather, here's what you should do, and Web 2.0 is an example of where we're led by these principles. I'm running out of time, but let's look at Second Life, just for fun. And again, Second Life, does it provide us with examples? Yeah, that's one of its strengths. Does it allow correction and criticism? Well, Yeah, okay, yeah, people can communicate back and forth, so I guess sort of, if you can find them, you have to find them first. Rethinking and rewriting, can you reuse content in second? Well, no, actually they made that illegal. You can't unless you pay them money for it. Okay, well, Second Life, does it support interaction in a genuine voice? Yes, again, that's one of its strengths. It's an online community. It's a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. So yeah, it does support interaction. It supports experiences, people can express their opinions, they can create their own personal identity, although one of the problems with Second Life, at least in my view, is that there are limitations on that personal identity. You have to be one of their names, you can't choose your own name. Is it a simple and consistent interface? It's mostly consistent. As to whether it's simple, some people have said that, well, no, it's not that simple. I read an article just today, in fact, that speculated, could we use Second Life to replace a university in the event of a natural disaster? And first watch, oh yeah, it's a neat idea. But then came the criticism, well, it's not like Second Life is simple. It's not like people can just jump onto Second Life and suddenly start using it. They have to go through a training period, which means that everybody in the university will have to have been trained on Second Life before Second Life can be used to replace the university in the event of an emergency. And it's just that sort of thinking. If Second Life were designed differently, where you could just log on to it and just intuitively understand how it works, kind of like life, then it would work a bit better. Then you could use it. So you sort of look at Second Life and you ask, well, you ask yourself, how could it be designed to be simpler to use? Where was it? Okay, simpler. Is Second Life accessible where and when I need it? Well, is there a Second Life API? Can I use Second Life, say, in Facebook? Well, I don't think so, not yet. I certainly can't use it in my blog. There's the Second Life URL, so there's some linking, but it's not nearly as portable as I would like. How reliable is it? How diverse is it? Are there many worlds? No, there's only one world in Second Life, although there's many others. There's only one world. There's only one company that runs it. That's a concern. Autonomy. How autonomous are the members in Second Life? Well, they're pretty autonomous, but then again, there is the benevolent government of Linden Lab, which overlaps everyone. So that is a question that people ask. Connectedness. Can Second Life be connected to external applications? Well, as I say, a little bit, but it's not clear that there are good Second Life application programming interfaces or ties to other applications. And how open is it? Can anyone contribute? Can anyone view it? Well, this is a point of criticism of Second Life. So, I know I'm hitting, well, it says 1:29 a.m. here. I can only imagine what time it is there. But I've given you a few examples of how you can take the principles that I've just described, and you take those principles, and what they're intended to do, right, is to not to define absolutely the world is like this, but rather to give you a particular frame of reference from which to view these applications. Again, the traditional way of viewing these things is to think of them as publishing applications or content transmission applications or courseware, right, or things like that. And really, they're not that kind of thing at all. They're personal learning applications. They're network learning applications, which means that the properties of these applications are different. The properties of successful instances of these applications are different than would be the properties of a successful, say, book or movie or magazine or newspaper. So that's essentially the talk that I wanted to give. I hope that my tiredness wasn't too much of an impediment. I really appreciate your interest and your patience with my less than clear sometimes explanation. So thank you very much. Thank you.
because it's there. You actually do it because there are some really good learning principles behind it. And to keep them in mind, as you say, the frame of reference when we're thinking about which one of those might be useful to us. Are there any questions from the audience for Stephen? I would be really interested in our
Can I ask, was anyone able to record it?
Yes, we did get two people doing an audio recording. We might have missed the title of your session to start with, but I'll certainly be in touch with you afterwards to where we might locate that so that you can access that as well. But excellent idea.
Great.
I've also realised during this conference that we have needs for our organisation to review whether we are modelling and using the Web2 tools for our own community, and things like capturing the MP3 of the keynotes would be really good for review later on. So, thank you.
Thanks a lot.